Well, thank you very much. It's always an enormous pleasure to come to the Foundation for Science and Technology events. It's on this occasion particularly nerve-wracking because two far more expert individuals have spoken. And what I want to try to do is just to throw out a few ideas that perhaps take us forward in the way that UKRI is thinking about the world that we're operating in, and to begin a conversation about a world in which ODA is not playing as large a part, not that it's not there, but it's not playing perhaps as large a part as it did before. The place I want to start, though, and I am going to speak mostly about UKRI, but I do actually want to start in Africa. So actually what I want to say is, if there's a thesis running through this, is that one of the things that we need to change is an argument which starts from UKRI and then looks out, and rather to start in Africa and then bring that into UKRI. It's, I think, incredibly important that we spend long enough thinking about different narratives that Africa is telling of itself. It's so important that we don't get stuck in a narrative of gloom or of conflict or of all those things. They are true, but they're true in Europe right now. We have no exceptionalism here. And some of you will know that I can't really give any public speech without reading a poem. Oh, there's a very interesting poem by Ben Okri, which is called An African Elegy. And if you get the title, you think, oh, God, I know where this is going, right? An African Elegy. Oh. And instead, he says, there are secret miracles at work that only time will bring forth. I, too, have heard the dead singing. And you think, oh. And then he says, and they tell me that this life is good. They tell me to live it gently, with fire, and always with hope. There is wonder here, and there is surprise in everything the unseen moves. The ocean is full of songs. The sky is not an enemy. Destiny is our friend. It's a wonderful poem in its completeness. And it just reminded me again and again of the fact that when we think about Africa, we should think about richness. Phenomenal capacity in terms of minerals, in terms of natural resources, and in terms of demography, as we've heard. We should think about innovation positively. The WIPO has some really interesting stats, which says, okay, if you stack African countries up against European countries, then their index of innovation doesn't look so good. But if you look at how they're performing, given where their economy is, they're outperforming European countries in their innovation index. So there's something really fascinating about how, from where you are, you're moving faster. And as we all know, moving faster from where you are is one of the things that we really need to do right now. And it's really important, I think, to think about Africa-centred solutions so that the problems which are being answered are the problems that come from Africa rather than the problems we perceive that we force on. So as an example, it's very easy, I think, for us to think about things like solar power. Great one. There's lots of sun. Let's do solar power. Of course, a lot of solar power is itself, the construction of it, quite damaging in terms of its environmental impact in the bits and pieces that create the solar power. There's a really interesting Innovate project which is co-created with African innovators to produce very, very sustainable solar power energy kit. So you're not only getting things which are doing good in terms of energy production, but they're not having then an effect on the environment, which they would do if they came. They're quite disposable items because of conditions, etc. Our versions were creating a different problem. The African versions are solving that problem and producing the energy. So that's that, just to start off saying, okay, well, let's think about Africa in all positive ways. And then that takes me to ODA. So obviously, official development assistance is an incredibly important tool that we have used very effectively to support UK universities to engage with problems across the global majority global south. And it's done great work, no question about that. But I framed it in that way because I think that was what happened. It supported UK universities to do things, which is great. I mean, that's very, very important. But it's not the only way to think about the way that science can be constructed. When one looks at some of the evolution of the ODA programme, and as people here will know that I came into my role in International Champion with the first reduction of ODA and the difficulties that arose there, one of the things that emerged out of that was the Ayrton Fund. And the Ayrton Fund was looking very hard at ways of producing a kind of a set of solutions around energy that were really based in creating growth, creating ideas, creating capacity in country. And Ayrton was a big enough and capacious enough fund that it joined things up. And I think that's important because a lot of old ODA, GCRF and Newton, brilliant as it was, were quite discrete small packages. There's something to be said for saying that was a mode of functioning which has value, but another mode of functioning is to take a big challenge and throw an awful lot at it. And you can see that across climate, across health, across demography, across a whole range of things, many of which have been picked out, actually, these are intersecting problems and intersecting challenges, and having more umbrella projects is a very interesting and challenging way of thinking. What would, for instance, an Ayrton 2 in health look like, or an Ayrton 3 in materials? And what in particular would future Ayrtons look like if they respected what I see in, for instance, engagements at the Global Research Council, which I was at in Saudi Arabia recently, where the notion of the distinctions between hard science and, say, arts, humanities and social sciences aren't being made quite as sharply as they sometimes are in the UK, which means that there's a people-centred approach to driving innovation and driving research and science. I think that's quite interesting. Obviously, in order to do that, well, one needs consistency of funding. And for that, the question, it seems to me, that arises is, once you've gone through this sort of argument, say, OK, there's a huge amount that we should be looking to Africa for, not to look at the gap, but look at the richness. And then you think we should actually be looking at these big problems together. Then the question is, why ODA? Why is ODA the mechanism that we decide to use? There are very good things that ODA could do, but we've just heard this government make a commitment in a really tough financial settlement situation, not only for the UK, but really across Europe, into North America, and some of the things that are driving some of the difficulties that we're seeing in countries like the United States of America, across Europe, Australia, is a crunch in the liquidity. This government has made a commitment to put a lot of money into R&D. We can use that money flexibly, and we should use it flexibly. There are some very interesting multilateral opportunities, including American-led global research centres, which have not yet been removed, including other kinds of multilateral fora, Belmont being one obvious example. There are the ways in which we can collaborate with, large elephant in room, Horizon Europe. What is FP10 going to look like if it's about competitiveness? Is it going to look about competitiveness in Europe that has no look to the rest of the world? I don't think it will. Then the argument that we're all going to have is that competitiveness about Europe, or is that competitiveness about the way in which Europe engages with the rest of the world? And Africa would be a very good example. And there are ways of doing that, and doing it equitably on the whole pays well. So this seems to me to take us to thinking about, well, okay, if this is the case, we're going to have to work up to this. There's not huge amounts of grant funding money available. The systems are tight. So where should one look? For stability and consistency that is actually genuinely respectful of opportunity. And I think here, things like the way that universities are looking at partnership, at capacity building, and that's also true for STFC, for instance, which is doing some great capacity building work, MLC doing very important capacity building work, NERC doing important capacity building work. All of our research councils are thinking very much about partnership and growing capacity, not just somebody else's capacity, but our collective capacity. Our collective capacity, that suddenly bursts out of a let's find this pot of money that has a particular badge on it, and then we're constrained by its limitations, into let's look at across our whole budget and see what are the ways in which we can collaborate. So that's my sort of positive. It's an important day for all of us with the spending review announcements, with the strong support for R&D. But I want to say something just to close about some threats. In the world that we are in, it is incredibly important that some of the things that we do when we think about competitiveness and we think about growth in our own countries don't subtly pull the rug from underneath burgeoning economies and innovations that are happening elsewhere. And Ambreen has mentioned one of the ones that I worry about a lot, which is open science. So there is a risk that we start moving back at some of the advantages that open science gave us. That would be very bad. But I think there's something else. My view very strongly has always been that science is not open if it disappears 10 years after it was published. The cost of long-term digital preservation is enormous. We haven't cracked it in the UK and in Europe. We must support others to be able to work for long-term digital preservation too. And we can't have a situation where we find a way that is a solution for us but isn't a solution for others. And that has broad implications, I think, across the global majority, global south. The second is borders. And there's an easy, obviously an easy line, which is to, you know, talk about immigration and so on and so forth. But I wanted to talk about something slightly different, which is there is always a risk when one drives into national sovereignty or national capability and sovereign capability to start forgetting the fact that how much is achieved by jointly co-created centres like the British Institute in East Africa, like the MRC centres, which had done amazing work over decades, and that by being genuinely part of their environment, located properly in their environment and respectful of it, they've done great things. They're not national capabilities. British School at Rome and the British Institute in East Africa have that name in their title, but I think it would be a case of both of them and the other international research institutes that they belonged to an international community. And we must hold that notion of international capability very dear. Thank you.